The Natural Nurse with Ellen Kamai and Dr. Z, Mondays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Joining me, this is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, and we're here today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We love being part of the Progressive Radio family because you can listen live with us every Monday, 1 to 2 p.m., right here on Progressive Radio Network, or you can listen in anytime at your convenience by just going to the archives and then checking out The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and while you're there, visit many of the other fine shows delivered directly to you by the Gary Null Network. I'm happy to introduce my guest for today. His name is Norris Baron. Mr. Baron is a business executive and the author of several books, including Prostate Cancer, Hope is Not a Strategy, and his up-and-coming book, How to Become CEO of Your Healthcare. Mr. Baron offers solutions and resources for managing medical issues and taking charge of your own healthcare. He himself is a cancer survivor, and he shares sound, concrete strategies for making sure that you are receiving the best healthcare possible, no matter what your health condition may be. Mr. Baron will discuss healthcare reform as well, which is certainly an important topic today, and emergency preparedness for families and business, which is on everyone's mind as well. He'll define new terms that appear in healthcare reform language and describe what they really mean. So thank you so much for joining us today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Now, at your website, choicesforprostatecancer.com, there's a lot of great information for people. What made you write that as your first book?
I was 2 years beyond my cancer surgery, and I really had not told anybody except my immediate family about that experience. I just decided that it was personal and private, and I didn't want to do anything with it. But as time went on, I kept hearing stories in the media about another celebrity that got prostate cancer, found it too late. It was well beyond the point where perhaps a great outcome would have been possible. And that really got to me. And I said, you know, this is crazy. I had a good outcome because I did a lot of things that I felt were different than what most people do. And I sat down one day and just decided to start, you know, I got a Word document in front of me on the computer and I started writing. And the next thing I know was I had a draft of the manuscript. And I said, this is something that I really now want to begin to share with everybody because I think there are so many treatments for prostate cancer. It is a disease that is totally treatable, and people need to know it, and a lot don't. So that was the beginning of it.
Well, so luckily for you, though, it looks like it's several years past now, and you seem to be back in good health.
Yeah, it's 3.5 years. It'll be 4 years in October. My urologist uses the word cure. I know there's always guarded optimism, but it is what it is. So far, it's been fine.
Well, that's good. And then you also have on your website the fact that there are a lot of natural therapies that are actually quoted in mainstream medical literature, such as the Journal of Clinical Oncology, where they're looking at things that actually can help improve outcome.
You know, and that's an area that a lot of people talk about, and of course there's no question that it's controversial with the medical community, but, you know, years ago I used to hear about the value of eating tomatoes, for example, or the value of pomegranates as, you know, something that would help the system perhaps retard the growth of cancer cells. Certainly, there, you know, even today there's a lot of hormone therapy and a lot of other products, I guess I would call them, because they're coming from most commonly retail outlets. And I don't have a lot of data as to outcomes. I think it really depends on the more critical factors about your medical history and your family history and things about you that are particular before a doctor will decide whether or not some of these treatments are appropriate. The larger issue, I think, is that there are so many treatments available today that are not necessarily surgically based, and that is, I think, the important part.
So things that could be perhaps a little less aggressive or detrimental for overall health and wellness.
Yeah, for example, watchful waiting is one that a lot of doctors recommend, again, based upon the absolute condition of an individual patient. In my case, that was the very first thing that was suggested as an option. I chose not to go down that road. I ended up having what's called the prostate cancer radioactive seeds, and, of course, radioactivity is much in the news today.
But, oh, isn't it? We'll get to that soon.
Yeah, but that was my choice. Surgery was never an option for me, and there's an important story behind that, which I hope we can get to before we get done today.
Well, now would be a good time to share it.
Well, you know, everybody talks about surgery, and for my money, and I'm guessing for anybody else that's in a similar situation, surgery in that part of the body is about as least attractive and least desirable because it has so many side effects. Incontinence and impotence are two of the most common side effects, bleeding, a lot of pain, et cetera. And I heard a number of stories over the years about men that have had surgery, and it just sounded like something I really didn't want to have. Because I was early stage, because it was very small, the cells of the tumor, because it was slow growing, I had a lot of options. And I felt that I wanted, based upon the data that I looked at, the outcome seemed to have been as good with surgery or a robotic surgery or some of the other radiation techniques as it would be with the prostate cancer seeds. And I guess I'm lucky because we had a facility in my area that has done more than 10,000 of these surgeries, and the data that they had, which I believe was credible, was very similar to others. And I said, you know, if I'm a candidate for it, I don't know why I'd want to go under the knife. And I decided not to, and I didn't, and I'm very pleased with the outcome.
Well, that's good that you took the time to investigate these things yourself. In other words, you were your own advocate. It's not something that your physician went over with you.
There's no question about that. One of the things that I talk about, I go into the workplace and I talk to employees about some of these things, and the one message that I want everybody to hear is the notion of you need to become the CEO of your healthcare treatment team if and when you need it. Somebody has to make decisions, and doctors, for the most part, I have found that doctors do not want to make the decision. They want to give you options. They want to give you alternatives. They want to give you all the information that they can possibly give you. But there is so much information that is available to us today. If you know how to find it, if you know how to read it and understand it, and if you know how to select the good from the bad, and that's not easy necessarily, but it's something that I've been doing in my business for years and years and years, so for me to read an article or a study is not something that is beyond me. And I was able to go into my doctor's first appointment very well informed because I knew a lot of questions that I wanted to ask to help me make a decision. And that was that in and of itself, because I did all that research and reading, was so important. It made me a very prepared patient.
Now, is this something that someone might get from reading your book, Prostate Cancer? Let's say a gentleman finds out that this is an issue he needs to deal with. Would getting your book help him interact with his doctor as an educated healthcare consumer?
Absolutely, and that's the reason why I wrote it. It's only 100 pages, so it's a short read. It's a story. It's a story about my experience. It's not built with a lot of overwhelming medical facts. It's built with a lot of information that I learned. But, for example, I have 60 questions that I've already pre-prepared in my book that are very helpful for the patient to be able to go into the doctor's office with in their hand, in an envelope, and say, I have some questions I'd like to get some answers to. Now, you could do that either before or after your discussion with the doctor. I'm sure a lot of the issues would come out. But when you leave there, you'll have a very good idea about your options. I list the 20 different treatments in a very simple, non-medical way so people can really appreciate some of the options, some of the, as I said, the side effects, some of the good, some of the bad. So it's very quick read. It talks about me. It talks about how I felt. It talks about how I made my decisions. It's the kind of book that you want to have, you know, when you're sitting in the airport, even sitting in the doctor's office waiting for an appointment. It's a great book to be able to go through and just get a lot of good information without becoming a doctor.
So it's from the patient's perspective.
Absolutely, and it's not only is this from the patient's perspective, but it's from the perspective of people that just don't know anything about medicine and don't want to know anything about medicine, but they want to know how to be able to make a good decision. At the end of the day, it's about making a good decision for yourself and then not getting surprised. And knowing, part of this whole business of prostate cancer, like so many diseases, is the unknowing. What's going to happen? How long will I be out? How much pain will I endure? What are the outcomes? What are the possibilities? I'm trying to help people get all that information in a general way up front, reduce the stress and the worry and the anxiety, and give you the tools that you need to be able to understand what's happening and how you can decide what you need to do.
Well, what you just listed, are those some of the questions that you share in prostate cancer? Hope is not a strategy?
Absolutely. I'm real interested in finding out whether or not people can make sure that they understand some of the side effects, and that's really important. Just give you an example. I'm looking at page 28, for example. Question, is my prostate cancer localized or more advanced? How long do you think I've had it? Question, what's the prognosis? Is it treatable? Question, what happens if the cancer is detected outside of the prostate during surgery? These are important things, but they will allow you to have reduced anxiety.
Excellent. That's really good. Now, just let me ask you, is there any discussion of herbal remedies and food choices that could be helpful?
You know, I did not, because I wasn't familiar with them, and because I was not, it was not something that at that point in time I had even thought about. I wasn't even aware of it. I was looking mostly at the medical side, so I didn't get into that to any extent at all.
Well, I'll share with listeners here that there are many food choices that can be excellent, particularly when preventing prostate cancer and, in fact, any kind of cancer. And there's certainly great data showing that people who follow more of a vegetarian diet rarely ever develop prostate cancer, as well as decreased consumption of dairy products is also linked in an inverse proportional way. That means the more dairy you eat, the more likely you are to get prostate cancer, and the less dairy you eat, the less likely you are to get prostate cancer. And then, of course, there's herbs that show some very excellent efficacy and very low possibility of adverse effects, such as saw palmetto, for instance, which is a berry that grows on a bush in Florida. So those can just be added in along with the great information that you share in your book.
Let me ask you a question, because this, I think, would help. How much in advance of adulthood or prostate cancer-bearing years, I guess would be the question, would one have to start some of these regimens? Is this something that one, I mean, obviously starting as a child would be a good thing, but is it practical? Or is it something that could be done later in life?
Yes, it definitely can. Just like these new cigarette commercials that are on showing that, you know, 1 hour after you stop smoking, there are improvements and there's less devastating effects on the tissues. Equally true with your diet. As soon as you switch off pesticides, off herbicides, and the problem with meat is not meat itself as much as the fact that commercial meat is so loaded with hormone products, such as diethylstilbestrol, growth hormone, etc., and antibiotics and all the other things that are used in farming practices and in agribusiness farming practices. And those things are called xenoestrogens. They have estrogenic receptors, and they also can sometimes fit into testosterone receptor sites, both of which are found in the prostate gland. So, it's any time you start is better than never.
Okay.
But, of course, as you say, you know, the earlier the better. That's going to give you the most protection. But be that as it may, you also talk a lot about healthcare reform, and that is something that's very big on people's minds right now.
Yeah, it's big on not only we employees, but also those of us that are unfortunately employers of people. It's having a big impact, not only now because of the uncertainty that's created and the confusion, but also coming out of a recession, there's just not a lot of good information on this change in the law, and people are concerned about how they're going to be able to fund some of these changes as well as recover. So It is a major, major issue, and it's caused a lot of business people a lot of sleepless nights.
Well, you know, that term is bandied around so much. What exactly is health care reform?
Well, there's a number of pieces to it, but let's start with some of the basics. Initially, we now have a situation where children can become insured regardless of any medical issues, and that's a big accomplishment. We have that same provision that will become prominent in 2013 so that any adults that need to acquire new health insurance will be able to have that health insurance regardless of any pre-existing conditions. So those are two big steps right away. You've got some minor changes in Medicare for the moment, but I'll step aside on that and talk about the whole issue of health care reform. What we're looking at today is a window between now and 2013 where businesses will have to provide coverage, or people will, or if they don't provide coverage, there will be financial consequences. There are a number of tax issues that need to be addressed. Small businesses under 25 employees, small businesses under 15 employees have different levels of responsibility. But at the end of the day, the bottom line is healthcare costs are going up. Healthcare reform is supposed to change that, and it won't, because of some of the mandates that are being put on employers. For example, the notion of you have to buy coverage. You have to have coverage on your employees. If you don't, you'll pay a fine. Employees are going to have to get coverage. They're going to have to buy it on their own if they have to, and employers will have to pay for it, albeit there may be less cost to them under some of those arrangements. But at the end of the day, business still is going to have to provide benefits to its employees. It's the way to remain competitive. It's the way to be able to provide the kind of programs that will encourage people to come to work for you, will want you to stay, and to continue to recruit. So the issue really is, when we call it health care reform, it's not really reforming what it was supposed to do, and that's take the control away from the insurance companies in terms of unregulated cost, unregulated increases in premium, denial of coverage, and put it in a way that people could have a more balanced playing field.
But with all of this, supposed to be. Those are very excellent points that you're bringing to bear, Norris, because you're saying that perhaps that was the original concept.
Yeah.
But how much of that have we gotten? Because I know right here, for instance, I work with Nature's Answer, and it's a supplement company, and we've been in business since 1972, and I do work on a lot of the herbal formulations and supplements. Now, you know, we just got a letter saying that our health care cost is going to go up, and I know that the company is not alone in facing that. So I don't think that this new health care reform really did much to make health care more affordable.
Well, it's not. It's part of my life as a business consultant. I work with companies, and I have just finished two rounds of renewal negotiations with my clients and their insurance vendors. And, you know, 26% in one case and 22% in another case was the increase. And some of that is going to have to be absorbed by reduced benefits. Some of that's going to be absorbed by the employer, and some of that's going to have to be absorbed by the employees, and that's not a good thing. You know, employees right now are hurting because either if they are employed, they're probably working a lot less hours than they used to work, for example, so their salaries are down, their income is down. Now they're going to have to undergo an increase in their health insurance out-of-pocket costs, as well as the premium costs. So this is not going in the right direction. It's not doing what it was supposed to do, politics aside. It's just not going where it needs to go.
And what about those people who aren't employed and still can't necessarily purchase insurance because it's just not affordable, and it's less affordable than it used to be?
It's a big problem. I've seen some packages of coverages for people that are exactly in that situation, and you're talking about $1,200-$1,500 a month for a family that's not working. That's not doable under any circumstances.
Now, how is that going to work in terms of, now I have not studied this much, but you know, we hear talk of the fact that you will be required to purchase health insurance. And what if you cannot afford to? What goes on then?
Well, the individual doesn't have a mandate to buy health insurance. That is something that was thrown out, as you recall. But corporations.
No, I don't remember that being thrown out. Is that true?
Well, as an individual, you don't have to buy it. You're given the choice to buy it. Okay? Well, the concern that I have is the money that employees now get for health benefits is tax deductible to the employer, and it's not taxable income to the employee. But if you have to go out and buy your own coverage, by whether it be from a health insurance exchange or some other source, the states are supposed to be developing their own health insurance exchanges. But if you have to go out and buy your own, now if your employer gives you additional money, less than he would pay for premiums, but more money to pay for health insurance, that now becomes taxable income to you. So now you're paying income tax on top of the fact you have to go out and buy your own insurance. This is not a good situation.
Now, again, so you're telling me that it seems like I'm still reading, or there were some cases about the fact that it might, in fact, be constitutionally illegal to require everyone to purchase health insurance.
That's part of the issue. That's why so many of the states have taken on this challenge, because they are concerned about the fact that the employer is being mandated to buy health insurance. What the government is doing is making insurance available to everybody, one way or the other. But they're telling companies, you have to buy it. And you have to buy it. You have to make it available, which means you have to provide it to your employees. Now, small employers have exemptions, at least to a certain small extent. Larger companies, for at least the first year, are getting what's called waivers. So some of the benefits that are being mandated to them, they're getting away with not having to comply with, at least for the first year. So there is a lot of confusion as to what is really going to be the outcome.
Well, there's a lot of confusion, except for the fact that it seems to be something that's going to cost everybody a lot more money. That doesn't seem confusing, but everything else does.
For less benefits. Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of language in this health care reform that we're going to share with our listeners, and perhaps you might not know, listeners, what does the law mean by treatment team, cost changes, one size fits all, patient-centered care? Sometimes these things are newspeak, and we're going to be talking about that when we come back to continue our show here with guest Norris Baron. But right now we're going to take a little break. Hear an update about all the wonderful shows that you can listen to right here on Progressive Radio Network. You are listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z with Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, and we will be right back with more.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Adam Coulter with Brooklyn Jazz Underground Radio. We'll be here every Tuesday from 5 to 6 with great music, interviews, and live performances right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. Again, that's Tuesdays from 5 to 6, or you can listen anytime at the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com.
This is a state of emergency. No, it's not. It's more of a state of urgency. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm on the radio Fridays at 1 p.m. right here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, offering a different narrative to the news, challenging what we're hearing, what we're seeing, what we're reading, offering another way of understanding what's going on. Join me online on MediaChannel.org and join me here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com Fridays at 1 p.m. Be there. Or be square.
Mike Fader here. Every Thursday following Gary Noll from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time, I will expound and expand on stories, both personal and public, attempting to make the sometimes ephemeral but always essential connections between our internal landscapes and our external lives. So please join me, Mike Fader, Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time for The Turning Point, here on the Progressive Radio Network.
Calling all women. Are you looking for truthful answers to help you safely and naturally navigate the many hormonal challenges that you face during your lifetime? This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. I'm a naturopathic doctor, author, psychotherapist, writer, and women's health advocate. Join me entering into the Women's Healing Circle, a weekly call-in show with the holistic practitioners, authors, researchers, and wise elders who share truthful information, education, and wisdom. Join me every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time to enter the Women's Healing Circle, right here on Progressive Radio Network.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent points of view.
Much for coming back on board with us right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z on Progressive Radio Network. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, and we bring you this show every Monday, 1 to 2 p.m. right here on Progressive Radio Network. Also, you can always get in touch with us via email through naturalnurse.com or go to Facebook, The Natural Nurse, and you will find out that we do a lot of classes where you can actually come in person. For instance, we visit New York's Chinatown and have an Echo Tour for Cure, where you learn about herbs, ancient healing techniques, and visit Chinese apothecaries. It's like a day in another country. And we also take people regularly on herb walks, where we identify edible and medicinal wild plants that grow in our area, and we collect them and make them into medicine. You can also check out our books, such as The Natural Medicine Chest, Arthritis, The Alternative Medicine Definitive Guide, Weight Loss, The Alternative Medicine Definitive Guide, The Natural Guide to Great Sex, Cycles of Life, which is about herbs for women, and many of the other projects that we're working on, and you can find them at naturalnurse.com. Today, we have as our guest Mr. Norris Barron. And he's talking to us today about a book that he wrote, which is wonderful. It's for the prostate cancer patient, and it's called Prostate Cancer, Hope is Not the Strategy. And he also has another up-and-coming book, How to Become CEO of Your Healthcare. Mr. Barron offers solutions and resources for managing medical issues and taking charge of your own health. He himself is a cancer survivor, and he also share sound, concrete strategies for making sure that you're receiving the best care possible. We're also going to talk about health care reform and emergency preparedness for families and business. So thank you so much for coming back on board with us today, Mr. Barron.
Happy to do it.
And I want to tell listeners that your bio, as well as links to your website, choicesforprostatecancer.com, will be posted on the Natural Alternative site as part of Progressive Radio Network, so they can easily listen to this show again or contact you at their leisure. So we were talking about healthcare reform before we went to break, and you talk about, you know, there's a lot of interesting and obscure terms that might not always sound mean what they sound like, but maybe you can help elucidate that for some of us. When they're as part of this healthcare reform, what does treatment team mean?
Well, you know, today we have a primary care doctor for the most part, and as needed, we have specialists. So I think it's fair to say that medical care today is fairly well siloed, which means that you have to go from place to place to place, from doctor to doctor to doctor, test to test to test. Record keeping is separate, it's not consolidated. And one seems to be arguing the point that that is a bad methodology, it's inefficient, it's costly. So under the new health care law, we're going to have something called the treatment team. And the treatment team will basically be, there will be a primary care doctor. And everything else, allegedly, supposedly, is supposed to flow in and through that particular doctor. So we'll have consolidated record keeping. We'll have the ability for everybody to share in the test results, et cetera, making things a lot easier, perhaps even in the same facility that we don't have today, as opposed to going from place to place to place and getting a test and having to wait for results. A lot of this is supposed to be eliminated. Now, the pros, the reason why people argue this is a good thing is it's supposed to improve coordination and care and potentially outcomes. Less anxiety, less stress, less running around, less things for the patient to do, and more effective treatment. However, as I see it, unless other things improve, this coordination is not going to be as good as one might argue it should be. There may be inconsistent information. It may not be as coordinated as it needs to be. Communication, for example, between doctors' offices today still needs a lot of work. The use of email, the use of smartphones, and the use of other technology is just not all the way, as I say, to bright yet. So we really want to focus on that. The other thing that concerns me is there can be a lack of sufficient patient information from doctor to doctor to doctor to make an informed decision. So we have to make sure that the information is well in hand and that it's all together in one place. When patients are not present, when staffers meet, that could be a disadvantage. So those are some of the things that really concerns me. And sort of, I feel like sometimes the patient is going to be kept out of some of this activity, and I'm not sure that's a good thing.
Yes, that's true. I mean, that sounds to me just what you described, sort of as the regular HMOs, where they have sort of like a hip center, where they have a clinic, one building that people go to, and, you know, they're shifted around. If they have to get an x-ray, they go right within there. If they need to see a urologist, let's say there's one right there. But those things have tended to attract physicians, let's say, not of the highest caliber. And very often people are not too satisfied with that care, although they do comment on the convenience.
And I think that assessment is probably correct. I personally have never been involved in an HMO, but it's interesting you say that because I know people that have selected HMO benefits through their employer that I've worked with over the years. And I can tell you honestly, many, many people have said, maybe it's younger folks as opposed to people that have larger issues, but it seems like some people really like that concept that you described, and maybe the treatment team, to a large extent, will work out fine. But in many cases, you know, one can always argue, and I know women, I feel for women especially when they have to go and see a specialist, especially, for example, where there is a gynecology involved. People say, you know, I want to go to my own doctor. I don't want to go to a stranger. But yet it's done all the time when your primary refers you to a doctor that he knows and says, well, you need to go see this specialist. You're walking in the front door for the first time with somebody you don't even know. So I think we need to get over that fear that seeing somebody that we don't know or that we haven't personally selected is not a good thing. But I think we need to work through this and make sure that some of the concerns that I've mentioned ultimately become real solvable in terms of making sure the patient has input, making sure that patient is involved in all these discussions that knows what's going on. It's just not a whole group of people sitting around the table and saying, well, here's the data. No, here's the decision. Somebody tell the patient.
Now, what about the political ramifications? Because certainly in the news what I'm hearing is that the new surge of Republicans that are in government are going to try to basically completely throw this whole health care reform bill out. Is that possible?
I don't have a crystal ball, but I think that's not going to happen. I think the public, for the most part, well, let's back up. We are at a point where health care reform has not happened. I think that's fair to say. This is not a health care reform law for the reasons that we stated earlier, but in fact, it's going to make some changes. It's just not going to fix the problems that it was intended to do. Having said that, I think that because of the way the political process is working today, at least for the next 2 years, it's not going to be likely that this law will get overturned. Well, it may get overturned in the courts. That's possible. But at the congressional level, I don't think it's going to happen because no matter what, I don't think that the House is going to be overridden by the Senate and ultimately a presidential veto. So we're stuck with it. The question is how effectively can we clean up some of the bad things in it? Okay?
Well, That's a practical solution, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like anything else. You know, when you find that a car, people won't buy a car because it's just got problems, then would you throw away the whole car or you try to fix the problems? For the most part, it's more effective to try and fix the problems and make it a much better product. And I think traditionally that's what we do in this country, is we try to make something that's bad better rather than throwing it out. There have been exceptions, of course.
Now, what about cost changes? What does that mean?
Well,
in my book, it looks like cost changes means cost goes up.
Well, yeah, it does. The question is, when we talk about cost changes, what are we really talking about? Are we really talking about a shifting of cost? The concern that I have, of course, is when we talk, the way I refer to cost changes is we're talking about employers having to look at differences in the way that they're buying coverages, then the employee has to look at the benefits that they're losing and the increases on their end. So effectively, one way of looking at cost changes is all we're doing is we're kind of rearranging the seats on the Titanic. We're changing how we're spending the money, whether we're spending it out of our pocket, or whether we're spending it by virtue of reduced benefits, not getting coverage at all, or are we spending it in terms of who is paying what contributions for the premium cost. So that's one way, and probably the most common way that I look at cost changes is it's just you've got to be able to look at who's going to be paying for what and how. At the end of the day, the same dollar amounts are going to be spent. It's just a matter of who's going to be paying for them. The insurance company's going to be paying for them, or are you going to be paying for them as an employee, or is the employer going to be paying for them?
So that's what the changes are. Now, when they talk about one-size-fits-all medical guidelines, that's very interesting because in holistic medicine, it's the opposite. Instead of one-size-fits-all, and I am a holistic health practitioner, we talk about each and every individual gets a completely different protocol, not depending on their disease name, but depending on their individual situation. So one-size-fits-all is the opposite of that.
And that's the direction that I believe the healthcare law is going to push us into, the fact that, and let's take my case, for example, where I had 20 different treatments that are commonly available for prostate cancer. If, in fact, based upon my diagnosis, of those 20, only 3 or 4 are, quote, recommended or have some perceived higher value than others, that's it. Then I'm going to get that no matter what. So the point is that you're going to be looking at, as you say, you're going to be looking at the disease and the factors involving that, and a decision will be made, and that's what you're going to get. You will not have options. At least you may have options, but you're going to have to pay for them. And
so
I think
you won't have options that would be covered under the health care.
Yeah, that's right. That's what the one-size-fits-all means, is whether or not it'll be covered by the plan that you're under. We're getting away from all of these options. We're trying to reduce some of the more expensive costs and treatments because they may or may not be any better than anything else. There may be other reasons why, for example, as I mentioned earlier, there may be better side effect outcomes in one method of treatment that may have ultimately the same degree of success as another, but costs a lot more. I had seeds. That was X thousands of dollars. I could have had probably surgery that would have been a lot less money, and the ultimate outcomes may have been the same. Therefore, I would have had to take the lower cost.
Okay, that's scary.
Very.
So it gives you less choice. The
welcome
other thing that
welcome
I've
to
noticed,
healthcare reform.
Yeah, another thing that I've noticed that happens sometimes is when physicians who use natural therapies that are not part of that standard of care description, that the Office of Professional Medical Conduct uses that to actually go after them and sometimes suspend or revoke their license, even though the patients want that care.
I don't think anybody said it was fair.
Okay, so now what about patient-centered care? What is that going to mean for patients?
Well, patient-centered care goes back to the same principle, and that is whether or not the care for a patient is going to be focusing on that individual or going to be focusing upon either the disease itself or is going to be decentralized. Now, that's the opposite of the team approach. But what we're looking for is coverage is care that is going to be totally focused on that particular patient for whatever that patient's concerns are. That's patient-centered, as opposed to it being much broader and much larger without regard necessarily to, again, it's money-driven. Okay, it's being focused on what is the most effective, the most efficient methodology to treat the patients, as opposed to decentralizing it.
Huh? So that doesn't sound like it really has to do with the patient too much.
Well, you know, when I look at the words patient-centered, I'm only concerned about one thing: is this treatment really focusing on that patient and all similar patients in the same way, or are they being treated based upon their own needs? And again, the economics are we're going to be restricting the potential levels of treatment based upon what is more efficient and what is more cost-effective.
So what about now, really, if they look at cost-effectiveness, they should be instituted a really broad base of holistic interventions, because if you look at dietary changes, the use of botanical preparations such as herbs, and homeopathic interventions, which have a very good record both of safety and efficacy, and at a much lower cost, which is why many other countries do use that as the first line of defense in healthcare and only go to things that are much more expensive, such as pharmaceutical interventions and surgery, with a much poorer risk-benefit ratio after all kinds of natural therapeutics have been exhausted. But there doesn't seem to be any discussion about that in this current healthcare law.
I believe that's correct. I don't believe that I have seen any references yet to any other than approved medical procedures.
Now, what does exposures mean in terms of privacy of your medical record?
Here again, our technology in this country is wholly lacking in terms of how we record information. For example, only about 25% of the marketplace, of the medical providers, only about 25% are actually using electronic health records to keep track. When I go to my primary, for example, he's operating today on a laptop that he brings with him from treatment room to treatment room, and he does all of his recording on there, and it is all protected. We still have lots and lots and lots of paper records, for example. And under HIPAA, the level of privacy is so exact. Now, if you start changing the way some of these procedures and teams are going to be designed, the chances are we could lose some of that medical privacy, especially where we have people looking at records that we have not specifically authorized to look at them. That's an issue that's going to have to be addressed.
Well, yeah, I think you have much more risk than of perhaps being turned down for a particular kind of employment due to your medical records. And then they're going to be doing genetic testing as well. Is there any discussion that you know of in the law about genetic testing?
Not that I'm aware of. I have not seen it yet.
Now, also, what about medical screening? What kind of controversy does that ensue?
I'm glad you asked that. PSA testing, which is the blood test that's used primarily for screening for, as I tell my doctor, it doesn't show prostate cancer, does it? He said, no. The PSA test is a blood test that shows that there's something going on from visit to visit over time with the prostate. And that can suggest, but it doesn't absolutely suggest, the presence of cancer. But normally, in my case, for example, my blood test from prior results to the one that triggered the activity that ultimately got me into surgery showed an increase in the amount of PSA, the protein that was created by something going on in the prostate, and that change was what required me to go and have a biopsy. Now, under these screening controversies, whether it be mammograms or whether it be x-rays or MRIs, the concern is, A, false positives. In many cases, there's a lot of surgery that's done as a result of some of these invasive tests or MRI testing that result in false positives. So the key question is, if we have false positives or if we have surgery that's being done and we have side effects or we have infections or other negative outcomes result, the concern that is resulting is, are some of these tests really a good idea? The data seems to suggest that even with PSA testing, they're only catching about 43% of the cancers. So that's less than half. So the question is then, is that level of screening a good idea? the way we're doing it, or is there some other procedure, some other methodology that should be used? And I know, for example, in prostate cancer testing, there are a number of new procedures that are being developed. Some have not yet been released that will far and away exceed the PSA test in terms of effectiveness. The question then remains, is all of this screening really effective? Is it really telling doctors what they really need to know in enough cases to justify doing it? And that's the controversy.
And also, is there any kind of built-in way to work within this massive, ridiculous amount of paperwork? Let's say a new screening comes up that actually is quicker, faster, easier, and more accurate. How long will it take to implement that one instead of what's currently in the register?
I am suspecting that government, as well as private industry that's doing this work, is moving a lot faster. There are some, I just saw recently the results of some testing that will allow the blood to be able to be analyzed, but in a very different methodology, looking for, I guess they use magnetic particles to be able to distinguish good from bad cells. I'm guessing that because of the fact that there's so much pressure from, especially from the public, to find better ways, and now with this controversy, I'm guessing that we're going to move along a lot faster. There's also, in many cases, a whole lot more people around the world working on some of these projects besides just the United States. One thinks, you know, the most medical science comes out of the U.S., and it doesn't. So I think if there's anything that's going to happen that's good, I think the medical screening protocols are going to become more sophisticated, and they're going to move a lot faster.
Well, that's hopeful. What you said is certainly true. Actually, the United States lags behind much of the world, industrialized and otherwise, not in terms of perhaps billing practices, but in terms of overall health. So actually, we lag behind, I think, about 37 countries, even though we lag behind no one in terms of the cost of treatment. We are number one.
Yeah, I just wonder sometimes what it really costs to run the same Viagra commercial 1,500 times a day on, you know, the network channel news stations, as opposed to the cost of the product. I just wonder whether or not we could save a whole lot of money if we can get rid of some of the foolish advertising that goes on that invades our living room every day, hundreds of times a day. We see the same commercials. As a consumer, it really turns me off, especially when I see a two-minute commercial, which you almost never see, but some of them are that long. And the disclaimer is probably 60% of the airtime.
Isn't that amazing? If you listen to that disclaimer, I wonder who in their right mind would want to take the product. I guess they're hoping you put it on mute and just see everybody dancing around in the flowers. Just amazing. And so often so unnecessary and so overpriced to use pharmaceutical interventions, in addition to the fact that it often actually makes the disease process worse. So again, I would have liked to see, and in fact worked for in Washington, the inclusion of a lot more natural and holistic efficacious therapies that have been proven and evidence-based to be more cost-effective as well as much better for both the patient and society. So I would love to get some of that into this healthcare reform, but it does not seem to be there, as you said.
You raised an interesting question as to why it is so obviously excluded from the bill.
Well, what do you think?
Frankly, probably not a strong enough lobby initially. I mean, that I think at the end of the day is really where this legislation was written, is by lobbyists and not by government leaders.
And I think you're true. That's true, because the same day I actually participated with the Natural Products Association, which is a very large industry presence and does have its own lobby group in Washington. And the day we were there in various senators' offices, so were drug representatives. And there were probably 20 of them for each one of us.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, and clearly sad that things move according to money and those kinds of inputs.
But on the other hand, the products that you're talking about don't cost anywhere near the cost of my Zocor. Just $3 a pill or $2 a pill. So I guess the money for advertising and the money for the promotion is is obviously there because how much does it really cost to make the product? One argues, of course, that the cost of the research over many, many years, hundreds of billions of dollars of going into it. But here again, if we have the economy working for us in both ways. First, we're getting the money in to be able to afford this, and then we're getting the money in to be able to pay it back.
Well, so true. Now, another thing, we're getting really close to the end of the program, but we'll go just another couple minutes, because you also write about emergency preparedness, and that's certainly a hot topic today.
Interesting. It certainly is a hot topic, this whole business of the nuclear power plant's failure. And having been involved in emergency preparedness for the last 10 years, the one thing that just stands out so much for me is when one builds a nuclear reactor on water, well, this was not exactly on water, but was close enough to the water, I often wondered throughout this whole process why there could not have been a consideration for the fact that when you build something that close to water and it requires generators to be able to keep power going, why you wouldn't have planned for that level of flooding, which wiped out the generators, which knocked out the facilities, which has created all this chaos. But nonetheless, it raises the key and most critical point that I talk about to people around the country. And interestingly enough, the majority of the people that I talk to, coincidentally, are first responders. I do lots of programs for police officers and firefighters and public health workers and all sorts of government agencies, because I guess one could say they are so busy doing that they forget their own families. So we spend a lot of time talking to them. But the largest issue is people always ask me, well, how do you prepare? What do you think are the most important things in terms of preparing? And I always come up with the same initial response, and that is, if we sit back, whether we're in business or whether we are at a radio station or whether we're in a hospital, and we need to ask ourselves one basic question, and everything stems from there. What could happen to us at home, at work, wherever, and how will we respond, and we go from there? It's a very simple question, and I think what we need to do is look at what are some of the possibilities. See, people say to me, well, how would you prepare for an earthquake, or how would you prepare for a wildfire? From my perspective, it doesn't matter. It's not a question of how. It's a question of what could happen and how will we respond. The cause of the event is not nearly as important as how we're going to respond to the result of the event. And in many cases, the overlap is crazy. I mean, it's always about communication. It's always about getting people to safety. It's always about getting water. It's always about securing an area so that we can at one point or another go back into it. These are the same kind of repetitive features, whether it be a terrorist attack, workplace violence, hurricane, earthquake. How do we respond? So that's what I tell people as a way of starting.
Now, what about personal preparedness? In other words, what should we have ready to go in our homes? Because, you know, when it happens, it's kind of too late for just rhetoric.
Let me give you the most important thing that I worry about. The most important thing that I worry about in the home is a middle-of-the-night fire. Now, smoke detectors are a wonderful thing, except smoke detectors are usually on the outside of closed bedroom doors, which most people probably have. So to that extent, that's not much good. Let me tell you what I think everybody in your listening audience ought to remember. Three things that every member of the family should have at bedside every night, every day of their lives. One, a flashlight that works. Two, a good pair of shoes, not flip-flops, not shoes that you could not walk through burning embers or fire with. And three, a whistle. Something that you can blow rather than yelling for help and inhaling. You can blow and wake up anybody and everybody that you needed to tell them to get out now. Of course, people should practice getting out now, especially in two-story or multi-level or homes or apartments. But having those three things, so you can see where you're going, you can walk if you have to get out, and you can wake other people up, are the most important things that I think people should have at bedside every night.
Well, you know, some of those are very easy to get. You can just look around your house and make sure that you have them. But something like a whistle, you might not have.
And every dollar store, every discount store has a whistle, whether it be a sports whistle or a child's whistle, doesn't matter. But you know, they're extraordinarily inexpensive. You can buy a package of 8 plastic whistles at a dollar store for probably a buck. So it's not a question of cost. It's a question of knowing what to do and then doing it.
And what about for implications of longer-term problems? Like, what if just the electric goes out, you know, for an extensive period of time?
Well, again, I think people need to be prepared. We tell people, and this is very well-known and very common, everybody should have some kind of what they call a go bag, G-O, something that you can just grab and go. And what's in there? Well, again, a flashlight, some water, maybe a blanket or something to keep warm, or maybe an extra change of clothes. For people that take medication, maybe 3 or 4 days of pills you just throw in the bottom of the bag so you have it in case you're going to get thrown away from your house and you can't get back into an area and you can't get your prescription filled. The basic and most important essentials, when you take your old pair of glasses and put it in there, you've always got a pair of glasses with you if you can't find yours. I know at night I put my glasses somewhere, and it usually takes me a while in the morning to figure out where I put them, as opposed to having an old spare pair that's better than nothing. So what do you really need for 3, 4, 5 days? You need water. You need your medication, you need a good pair of glasses, you need to be stay warm or stay cool. Those are the most important things. We could fill up a go bag with all kinds of stuff, but those are the most important things. The people in Japan today need their medication, they need water. They need to stay warm somehow, but they need their medication, they need water. That's the things that they need most importantly to stay alive.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we've been listening to Norris Baron. You can check him out at choicesforprostatecancer.com or visit our website at naturalnurse.com for more information, or always go to progressiveradionetwork.com, look on archives, all the shows are posted. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, wishing you the best. Stay healthy.